Lecture 7, Etruscan Gods and Goddesses.
The Greek philosopher Xenophanes said that if horses had gods, their gods would look like horses. The forms and powers of deities reflect the societies that worship them. The Etruscans are no different. The major Etruscan deities, through their forms, powers, and spheres of influence, inform us about their concepts of the creation and structure of the universe, as well as the organization of the world and the place of people in that world. If Xenophanes is correct, then they also reflect the Etruscans who worshiped them, and so give us insight into Etruscan family, social, and political structures. Etruscan deities are more benign and act more collectively and less confrontationally than do Greek or Roman gods. Before we look at individual deities, it's worth noting some general tendencies. First, while we're making direct contrast to Greek deities, it's worth noting that the majority of Greek gods act individually rather than collectively. They're relatively autonomous in their spheres of influence. That isn't the case with the Etruscans. Second, Etruscan gods and goddesses have complex identities, and in many cases, each one is associated with a great number of natural phenomena, life events, and social structures. It's not inconsistent, for example, for the Etruscans' goddess of child-rearing and nurturing to also take up arms and fight in war. The Greeks, by comparison, divvied up such qualities among a larger number of divinities. Third, before about 600 BC, Etruscan deities were amorphous, that is, without clearly defined shape or form. Consequently, there are no images of Etruscan gods before that date. Many were never fully anthropomorphized either, meaning that they never take fully human shape, always retaining some non-human aspects, again, in contrast to Greek and Roman deities. However, by the archaic period of the 6th century BC, Etruscan gods finally do emerge with human characteristics, and eventually, under the influence of Greek art, often take on some of the attributes and imagery of the Greek deities with whom they were approximately equivalent. Those Greek attributes, however, are like the flames I painted on my Honda Civic. They don't really change what's underneath. They clearly don't belong, and they're easily recognizable as aftermarket additions. So, when we discuss the Etruscan deities, I'm not going to spend as much time on the later Greek elements added to them. Well, the principal god of the Etruscans was Tinia, whose name derives from tin, the Etruscan word for day. In some ways, he's similar to other more familiar gods like Zeus or Jupiter, who each had a pantheon, our term for the group of gods and goddesses worshipped by a culture. Tinia is a sky god, like Zeus in the Greek pantheon or Jupiter in the Roman. His main sphere of influence is the sky, and he is associated with birds. Like those two, he appears as a mature, bearded man, and he wields lightning. He is often portrayed with a thunderbolt in one or both hands. That thunderbolt could be thrown as a sort of divine punctuation mark, signaling the end of a debate, or to signify that he had passed judgment on a particular situation. It marks a peacemaking element in his personality. Tinia is also the god of boundaries, who plays a role in organizing the cosmos and in controlling the division and use of land, in part through his command over any weather that might damage crops, such as wind, rain, and hail. Most surprisingly, and very unlike Zeus or Jupiter, Tinia is associated with the underworld. He appears in a variety of representations with terms, the Psychopompus, who led souls into the underworld. Terms is the Etruscan equivalent of Hermes, as seen in his messenger aspect. And in his subordination to both Tinia and Eta, Hades. Tinia, who is also known as Apa, father, has his closest parallel in the Norse god Odin, although he frequently is also compared to Zeus and to the Roman equivalent, Jupiter. Odin, the Norse Allfather, is a weather god, the king of the gods, and a bringer of victory in war. And he also had an underworld aspect, welcoming newly deceased warriors into the land of the dead. The Etruscans and the Norse each referred collectively to their gods as the Aesir, which is a term that means multiple gods, and in the Etruscan sense, specifically nine of them. Broadly speaking, the number nine was significant in both Etruscan and Norse pantheons, which sets them apart from the vast majority of Indo-European belief systems, where 12 is the more common number for a group of sacred figures. Think of the 12 Olympian gods of the Greeks and the 12 apostles of Jesus, for example. Now, it's tempting to trace these Norse figures, recorded centuries later, back to the Etruscans centuries before. We do know that some elements of Etruscan culture did make their way to the Norse through the Celts, but we do not know if the similarities between Tinia and Odin represent the transmission of the Etruscan notion of divinity to the Norse, or evidence of a shared understanding of the nature of the divine. Still, Tinia has more in common with the Norse Odin than with the Greek Zeus, and that is a useful observation. Another quality that sets Tinia apart from Zeus is his relatively circumspect use of force. In looking at Zeus and Greek heroes generally, one significant characteristic they share is described by the term autonomous violence. That is, Zeus smites who he wants to. Hercules, among other heroes, doesn't have to ask permission before attacking or killing someone. These Greek figures act individually and don't seek outside authority for their behavior. Collective action rarely comes up in Greek myth, so Greek heroes are defined by individual autonomous action, which is the source of the conflict in the Iliad, as a group of Greek heroes tries to operate as an army, taking orders and such. Spoiler alert, it doesn't go well. Well, by way of contrast, the Etruscan deity Tinia does not act autonomously or individually. If he wanted to throw a thunderbolt for any purpose other than as a warning, he needed permission from various groups of gods, such as the consenting gods or the shrouded gods, also known as the secret gods of favor, which I think would make an awesome band name. This idea is remarkable. It represents a severe check on the power of the gods. They must act in consultation with a group, usually nine gods. There's a noteworthy terracotta Etruscan plaque that depicts gods in council. All of them appear to be making speaking gestures, and all appear to be rational. That doesn't happen too often in other cultures. In Greek and Near Eastern myth, the gods meet in council, but they often don't come to any agreement other than to do what they individually want. Or one god threatens and blusters, and the others back down and let him or her do as they wish. I'm thinking of Ishtar, the Mesopotamian goddess of war and fertility, threatening to loose zombies on the earth when she doesn't get her way in council. The concept of consultation and collective action plays an important role in the Etruscan world, as representatives of the independent city-states meet regularly to discuss and debate collective action, usually against foreign foes. The concept was passed from the Etruscans to the Romans. In the Roman family, for instance, the father had the power of life or death over his minor children, but he was supposed to ask the consent of the other adult males in the family first. Roman government, which in many ways was modeled on the family, sees the transfer of that concept in the form of the Senate. Roman magistrates submitted matters to the Senate for a vote, and quite literally, for their consent. The idea and the term consent are very much alive today in the American Constitution, where Article 2, Section 2, lays out the U.S. Senate's role in ratifying treaties and confirming some appointments. The Senate is to provide advice and consent. So this Etruscan concept eventually makes its way into contemporary government. Now, Tinia had a female consort named Uni, who was the principal goddess of the Etruscans. She has been equated with the Greeks Hera or the Romans Juno, the goddess of marriage, and with some justification. But Uni also has key differences with them. The Etruscans actually compared her to Ishtar, using a Greek transliteration of her name, Astarte. And Ishtar is a much better parallel than Hera or Juno, as she was a goddess of love and fertility, as we have images of her nursing a small male child, as well as a goddess of war. Now, the conflation of love and war within one deity might strike us as odd, or maybe not. I was teaching this once, and as I was lecturing on Ishtar, one male student in the front row began nodding knowingly. It turns out he was recently divorced, and as you can imagine, he had experienced the intense feelings of love that transitioned into a bitter divorce. You know, I think one of the smart things that J.K. Rowling did in the Harry Potter books was to make love spells and potions so dangerous, and the people under their spells prone to violence. So, love and war together. Well, unlike Hera, the goddess of marriage, but like Ishtar, the goddess of love and fertility, Uni is associated with fecundity, and particularly with childbirth. Her largest sanctuary was near Capua, the Etruscan colony in Campania, where we've excavated thousands of terracotta and stone votive statues and statuettes of mothers and infants. Some of the most elaborate of these carved stone sculptures show the goddess seated on a throne holding anywhere from 1 to 12 swaddled newborn infants in her lap. In many myths, Uni nurtures the young, even those who are not her own children, including the Etruscan version of Hercules, Hercle, which allows him to become a god and join the family. By contrast, in Greek myth, Zeus and Hera are not the ideal couple, to say the least. They are pretty much the model of a dysfunctional marriage, marked by betrayal, jealousy, anger, occasional domestic violence, and the rejection of each other's children by different partners. Tinia and Uni are not like that at all. Rather, they seem to be the model couple, with a stable, peaceful, mutually supporting relationship. If their life together were a reality TV show, no one would watch it. No drama. This might explain why the Etruscans adopted Greek myth so early. It's just a lot more exciting. In addition, rather than expressing the animosity that characterized Hercules and Hera's relationship, Hercle and Uni operate as allies in a number of stories. Another aspect setting Uni apart from Hera and Juno is her warlike nature. In some stories, she fights with a spear and shield, her only armor a goatskin. Uni can wield the thunderbolt, as can Tinia. Now, Etruscan women enjoyed a remarkable amount of freedom and parity with men compared to any other women we know of in antiquity. Uni and Tinia's calm marriage and shared ability with the thunderbolt may thereby reflect the Etruscan ideal of husband-wife partnership. Now, after Tinia and Uni, the Etruscans' third most powerful deity, and one of the most commonly evoked, is Minerva. Her name develops into the Roman Minerva, and she's associated with Athena in Greek culture. But Minerva also has a number of differences from each of them. She's a powerful weather goddess, one of the nine wielders of the thunderbolt, with sky associations indicated by her wings. She's also a goddess of war. She carries and uses a spear. though her earliest representations show her in a dress. Minerva's cult was involved in healing, a conclusion supported by the terracotta votives of body parts found in her sanctuary and the sulfur spring at Veii, just north of Rome. Water, sulfur water that was used in ancient Italy as a form of antiseptic. Along with Aplu, the Etruscan version of Apollo, Minerva was a deity of prophecy, although it's hard to tell whether the prophetic aspect of her sanctuary at Veii is Aplu's alone. In keeping with her complex identity, Minerva also nurses and nurtures children. For example, she and Hercle both have a role in nurturing the child Epeira, either as his guardians, seeing that he's raised and then brought into divine society, or as I think more likely, as his parents. The representations of Minerva and Hercle show them embracing in a very affectionate way, the kind that leads to babies. In either case, it's clear that Minerva's relationship with Hercle differs in some key ways from that of Athena's with Hercules. What's more, Athena and the Roman Minerva were virgin goddesses, so neither had any sort of romantic relationship. Minerva also cares for a set of infants, at least three who are called Maris, which might be a title rather than a name. Unlike Epeira, who we consider to be divine and likely the offspring of Minerva, the Maris infants were almost certainly human. I judge this by their iconography of always wearing a necklace with a small amulet. This amulet is the bulla, a sort of locket worn by Etruscan boys from birth to manhood that was designed to protect them from evil. Some examples survive, but the majority of bulla images and surviving examples are Roman. It represents yet another quintessentially Roman cultural habit adopted directly from the Etruscans. Well, Tinia, Uni, and Minerva are perhaps the most complex of all Etruscan deities based on their spheres of influence, from the sky to the underworld. It's possible that they were also among the oldest of the gods. They're certainly the most important. Their cult statues were found together in tripartite temples that dominate Etruscan cities. Their most famous and long-lasting example is the Capitolium in Rome, which is the temple of Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, that is, the Roman gods who were derived from their Etruscan counterparts. The goddess Turin, however, is quite likely the oldest of all Etruscan deities. One indication of her extreme age is her form, which is not fully anthropomorphized. She has wings, an attribute of some of the oldest of the Etruscan gods. We see the same pattern with some Greek gods. Early images of Artemis, for example, a pre-Greek deity, show her winged, but her wings eventually disappear in favor of a fully formed goddess. More broadly, Turin represents the innate expectation of child nurturing that seems embedded in each Etruscan goddess's nature or myths. If you look her up, you'll find something that calls her the Etruscan Venus, a goddess of love or some such. Sort of. But that's very reductive and misleading. It's not enough for us, other than in one narrow linguistic sense. I say that because most Roman myths of Venus, like later Greek myths of Aphrodite, make her seem so flighty, petty, and insignificant, and that's misleading. Perhaps to get a sense of her power, we should start with the name Turin. Odd name. In fact, a very old name, and more of a title, really. In Etruscan, it means lady. Lady as in the Latin domina, female ruler. Interestingly, I think, her name is closely related to our word tyrant. Tyrant comes from the Greek tyrannos, which actually has pre-Greek origins. The root, tyran, means ruler. Turin, the goddess, is a non-Indo-European word for female ruler. She is, perhaps, close to the very earliest Greek ideas of Aphrodite. Aphrodite was born in the second generation of deities, out of Uranus, the sky, and Thalassa, the sea, according to Hesiod's account of the birth of the gods, the Theogony. Aphrodite rose from the foam on the water when Cronos threw the castrated genitals of Uranus into the sea. Thus, she's born of an act of sex and violence, a powerful early deity, and the eldest of all of the Olympians. Her primal power as a goddess of love is that of procreative sexual love. Later, her mating with Ares, the god of war, unifies the two concepts and the passion inherent in each. Indeed, her power might be the vestigial reason behind an interesting statement by Vitruvius, the Roman architect of the time of Augustus. In his book on architecture, Vitruvius says the Etruscans dictated that the Temple of Venus, Turin, should be outside city walls. He identifies only three deities to be kept from inclusion in the city: Vulcan, because of the risk of fire, and Mars and Venus, because they stirred such strong feelings among the citizenry that they should be worshipped outside the walls of the city. Turin appears in a great deal of Etruscan art, especially domestic pieces such as engraved bronze mirrors, vases, and such. Her image on mirrors makes sense given her association with beauty. In many representations, she appears with various expected attendants, including Lhasa, the goddess of fate, Thalna, the goddess of childbirth, and Malavisk, the goddess of the wedding. In some of these scenes, Turin holds a hand mirror of the type her image is engraved on. She's also seen with various male figures, including her lovers, Atuns, and Hercle. In earlier works of art, that is prior to the 4th century BC, she's elaborately dressed, coiffed, and bejeweled. In later 3rd century BC versions, she's often nude except for her high Etruscan-style boots. Like other major goddesses in the Etruscan pantheon, Turin cares for infants and small children. In some works of art, you can see her near Epiore, and in others, with Minerva and the Maris infants. She has her own son, Ternu, as well. This consistent notion of goddesses appearing as nurturers, no matter what their other attributes or personal strengths, seems to suggest an Etruscan belief that mothering is inherent in all women, whether they have their own children or not. Now, although I've mentioned a number of gods in passing, so far our attention has largely been taken up with Etruscan goddesses and their forms or attributes. It's time for a walk on the Y side. We need to consider and analyze the male deities of the Etruscan world. Here's an intriguing twist. There aren't as many as you might think among the Aesir. In fact, there aren't as many gods as there are goddesses in the Etruscan pantheon. That in itself is an interesting fact and might point to an Etruscan need to attribute more of the powers of the divine to the feminine than to the masculine. For example, Usul, usually called the god of the sun, appears in early Etruscan art as a male or female deity, female when rising, male when setting. Many of the gods we know of are clearly Greek imports after 600 BC. The Etruscan deities of Apollo and Hercules, for instance, were adopted from the Greeks and spread throughout Etruscan communities until by 500 BC, they seemed truly ubiquitous. This is because most Etruscan deities were rather obscure divinities of sky, water, earth, weather, or vegetation. These various gods do not lend themselves to imaginative myths or interesting stories of travel, seduction, battle, or love. So the figures and stories of Apollo, Apollo, and Hercules serve to fill those gaps. Now, I promised at the start of this lecture not to get too distracted by Greek imports. So let's instead explore the figure whom the Roman scholar Varro referred to in the first century BC as Deus Princeps Etruriae, the principal god of the Etruscans. Some scholars refer to him as the Etruscan national god. His name is Veltha, or Veltune, or Vortumnus, or Vertumnus, or Voltumna, which I think splendidly indicates his indefinite or ill-defined nature. He, or she, as gender is fluid for this ambivalent divinity whose appearance changed at will, was a deity of vegetation, the changing seasons, the rhythms of the natural world, especially crops. First century BC, Roman poets Ovid and Propertius took Vortumnus as their subject in extended passages. And these, along with the Roman scholar Varro, give us quite a bit of information about Vortumnus's abilities and attributes. For instance, each of the poets mentioned the god's shifting gender and makes mention of his connections to crops in the field, orchards, and gardens. Propertius wrote a poem in which he gave Vortumnus the voice to state, "Why marvel at the many shapes of my one body? My nature is adaptable to every form. Turn me, verte in Latin, into whatever you wish. I'll be noble. Clothe me in Cohen silk, I'll be no bad girl. And when I wear the toga, who will say I am no man? Give me a scythe and tie twists of hay on my forehead, you can swear the grass was cut by my hand. Once I carried weapons, I remember, and was praised. Yet I was a reaper when burdened by the basket's weight." It's fitting for a god who has probably worshipped for hundreds of years without human form to not be tied to any specific form or identity. Despite his or her apparent power and ability to control appearances, Vortumnus was as susceptible to the power of love as any other god or mortal. In the poem Metamorphoses, Ovid tells a story for which Vortumnus was a natural subject. In it, Vortumnus has fallen in love with the nymph Pomona, the divine patron of fruits and orchards. She's chaste, her only passion tending to her garden. But as is typical for a mythological figure, Vortumnus enters her garden in an ever-changing disguise to win her love. As appearing as an ox driver, after appearing as an ox driver, soldier, fisherman, and a farm worker of one kind or another, he changes into an old woman who advises Pomona to find a mate and proposes Vortumnus as worthy. This advice is bolstered by a story of unrequited love leading to suicide and sorrow. Finally, as Ovid writes, "When Vortumnus, the god, disguised in the shape of the old woman, had spoken, but to no effect, he went back to being a youth and threw off the dress of an old woman and appeared to Pomona in the glowing likeness of the sun when it overcomes contending clouds and shines out unopposed. He was ready to force her, but no force was needed, and the nymph, captivated by the form of the god, felt a mutual passion." I guess the lesson here is to be yourself, although that seems harder when one's godly self is ever-changing. Nevertheless, a happy ending results, as they so rarely do in Ovid. The contention that Vortumnus was the Etruscan national god has great support. His shrine, the Fanum Vultumni, was the most important sanctuary in the Etruscan world. Located outside the Etruscan city of Volsinii, which is modern-day Orvieto, it was the central gathering place for the religious, political, and military authorities from the 12 Etruscan cities that made up the confederation we know of as the Etruscan League. This sanctuary was the central space in Etruria, the same role held by Delphi for the Greeks. Religious ceremonies dedicated to Vortumnus and other deities were held annually here during a spring festival to ensure the propitiation of the gods towards the Etruscans for the coming year. Here, priests and religious officials of the League were elected each year at the same time. As part of the festival, a major regional market and games were held as well, although we don't have details of the type of games as we do for Delphi and Olympia. Political and military matters would have been discussed, including possible military campaigns that required cooperation among two or more members of the Etruscan League. The presence of this sanctuary, central to Etruscan identity and social structure, might explain why the Romans sacked Volsinii in 264 BC and took the remarkable step of resettling its inhabitants. When they did that, they took the cult statue of Vertumnus back to Rome and placed it in a shrine in the Vicus Tuscus, the Etruscan quarter of the city, between the Forum Romanum and the Forum Boarium, which were the two significant public civic spaces in the city. In Propertius's poem, Vertumnus is quite happy for the change. The important lesson we can take is that Etruscans worshipped spirits that were manifestations of the divine, whose forms and identities could and did change, and even their names could change. And yet, they were still recognizable in whatever form, and determining their will was critical to the continued success of individual and collective Etruscan activities.